Hello guys, thank you so much for joining this mini-series podcast. I'm very excited because we have with us an amazing woman who is looking after everyone, but especially women as well. Dr. Federica Amati, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
No, it is such a pleasure because we share patients, we share an idea about health, and we share this kind of quest to try and understand where things stem from. And I think once you enter the world of health with this in mind, funny enough, you meet people that are like-minded because it's a whole mindset to try and work this way. And we're trying, you know, a lot to share this philosophy to empower people to educate themselves about them and how they work. Because I think we think that a lot of health is about knowing yourself and recognizing things before they become bigger problems, and you can treat them. Our conversation today is going to be about the vaginal microbiome. I don't think many people even know that it's a microbiome there. They don't even know what a microbiome is. So I think what we're going to do, we're going to explain a bit what microbiome is. More specifically, what's around and in the vagina and the whole gynecological sphere, its connection to its physiology and metabolism. And then we'll see what can go wrong. And then how can we help it?
Yes.
But before that, can you please introduce yourself and tell us how incredibly educated and clever you are?
That's so sweet, Boniface, thank you. So I have a PhD in clinical medicine research. I am an academic. I still do research, very active in research at the moment, both with Imperial College and NEDPRO, so different bodies and some private clients too. But I'm also a registered nutritionist with the Association for Nutrition, and I very happily have clients, as you've mentioned, working one-on-one in nutrition, which I think is important when you're an academic to have that face-to-face time with clients too, to really know what people care about as opposed to just what we care about in academia. So I'm really excited to be here today to talk about the less popular microbiome cousin. Everybody is quite up to speed now with the gut microbiome. And I think that the oral microbiome, the vaginal microbiome, and the skin microbiome are sort of waiting in the wings to get recognized and to be spoken about. So I'm really happy you're doing this. It's so important.
I think I will tell about my journey, because I did medical school in the early 2000s, then obviously osteopathy, acupuncture. And yes, we were already quite in this kind of group of people thinking outside the box, I think, compared to very classical medical training. But the microbiome was just suggested. It wasn't really yet really kind of, firstly, I think it wasn't really understood. That's one of the things. There was no research in it. In the last 12 years, I mean, I'm mind blown by what I read, what I start to understand. And one little fact that's always funny for people to know is that you have more viruses, bacteria, and parasites inside, on, and around you than you have human cells.
I know, yeah.
So in a way, you're a carrier of this incredible world of microbiome, of all these little things. So maybe we're just a vehicle for this. We think we're the vehicle for the soul. Maybe we're a vehicle for microbiomes to do that.
Yeah, well, it's funny because microbes used to be thought of as just pathogens. So it was something to be avoided. It was something to bleach and get rid of. And now, of course, as you said, it has been really only in the past 10 to 12 years that we've realized actually, no, that they are so important for our health, and actually having the right population of microbes living within us, on our skin, makes all the difference between good and bad health. And of course, for those who are in the field, it's moving so quickly. So we learn more and more every year, and it's incredible to see how much we can understand now and how we can use it to tailor information, but also tailor programs and diets and interventions to really improve health in a fantastic way. And I think it's really important for people to understand the power that they hold in understanding their own microbiome. They're completely right. So I think it'd be good to say just what a microbiome is really just a term that's used to describe the collection of microbes, as you describe, viruses, bacteria, protozoa, and, you know, there are some fungi as well, that all live on us and in us, specifically the oral cavity. So in our mouths, we know there's a microbiome, which its balance or disbalance can really affect how our oral health is, our irritation, inflammation of the gums, and also cavities. Then there's the gut microbiome, which is the most popular one. It's the one that we are all buying probiotic live cultures for now, and we're all a bit more mindful, hopefully, about how important it is to have a healthy gut microbiome. And then there's the vaginal microbiome, which is, you know, half of us have it, but it's really underspoken about. I think, as you know, Boniface, with anything to do with gynecological health, often we don't talk about it. And actually, the vaginal microbiome has a massive impact on really important things like fertility, propensity to disease. It can impact your likelihood of getting an STI or having HPV. And it, in recent studies, it's also shown to impact whether changes in your cervix for cervical cancer progress to a tumor or not. So we're talking about really important effects that this microbiome holds. And then there's the skin microbiome as well, which again is, I feel like that's the one that's needs to have its moment maybe in like a few years' time. So we'll see how that develops. But for the vaginal microbiome, it's really, yeah, there's a lot to say for sure.
What an exciting time. You know, because this is moving so fast that, you know, we are discovering things all the time. And it's just, I mean, it's exhilarating. I think it's so exciting as a therapist to put it this way, that we can help these people this way. And it is about the empowering people understanding that. And it's not that complicated. I mean, it's very complicated to go into details, but what to do and how to understand it, the concepts are not that complicated to grasp. So I think this also, this information has to be spread. I'm just going to do a little, this month is Gynecological Cancer Awareness Month. And we partnered in a series with Lady Galvin Foundation, which one of the co-founders, Jenny Prince, is a lovely friend of mine, and all the other ladies as well. And I've learned so much with them through the last 7 years when I was working with them and following. But this year, even more, because I met with Dr. John Butler, for example. They have about a team of 10, 12 doctors working with them in the research department. And it's quite extraordinary because always, eventually, when we go into this conversation and intervention, what makes those cells change? You know, you're talking a minute ago about a cervix cancer, and it is the environment. Of course, it's multifactorial. There's a lot to think about the mind, about what we eat, about who we surround ourselves with, our friends, who loves us, who we love, but also this whole world of microbes. And as you said, bacteriovirus, which is around us, and fungi. Fungi is so important. I know everyone's getting a bit on it because there is this fantastic fungi from Paul Stamets that came out. People start to understand how mycelia connect trees and everything. You're not going to go there today, but my wife is a real big regenerator of Earth. I'm also falling into this. And it's just this constant awareness of this symbiotic connectivity in the biodiversity of all beings, from microbes to complex entities like humans. But anyway, sorry, that was my going a bit off. Let's go back into the subject of today, which is the vaginal microbiome. So tell us a bit, just tell us what it is, where it is, and what it can do or not do.
Right. So we're talking very much about the microbiome that resides in the vagina. It does also affect the vulva, so the external part of the female genitalia. And actually, recent research, very exciting, has shown that what we used to think of as being a sterile environment in the woman's womb actually isn't sterile. So we now think that the endometrial lining in preparation for pregnancy has its
That's the inside of the uterus.
So before you have your period, right? So during your cycle, what happens is that your womb lines itself with lots of blood vessels and really nutritious lining, essentially ready to welcome a new life. If your egg is to be fertilized, it has a soft cushioning known as an endometrial lining, which will be there to receive it and then to grow, you know, to help grow it, but also then form the placenta and everything else that's needed to sustain life. Now, we now know that the endometrium plays an important role with some glands inside it that actually release what's known as uterine milk to the egg before it's even connected to us with the placenta. So what you eat even before the egg has implanted directly impacts the uterine milk that your endometrium is then literally giving to your little fertilized egg as it travels down. And what we've
this
now,
is amazing.
Which is incredible, right? I was itself. Excited right. to read that. Yeah, it's mind blowing. And that's why, you know, there's a lot of what I try to spread when I speak to clients, when I write, is just to say that actually what we preconception is really important. I know that majority of pregnancies are unplanned. So this is not about panicking people who didn't plan to get pregnant. But if you are thinking you might get pregnant, if you're not using, you know, contraception, if you would quite like to get pregnant, and then really thinking about what you're eating before you get pregnant is really important, because from the word, from before the egg starts to mature, what you're eating is going to influence the whole process and everything. So this is endometrial lining, which not only has glands that produce milk, they also has its own microbiome. So now we're talking about a microbiome within the uterus and a microbiome in the vagina. Now, the microbiome in the uterus, we don't know as much about. But what we do know for the microbiome in the vagina is that it really doesn't like diversity, right? So whereas our gut microbiome loves diversity, the more diverse, the better, although it likes diversity of certain strains for good health. And as you said, Boniface, we know like the things that are helpful for those strains are whole plant foods, fruits, vegetables, roots, seeds, nuts. They love that. If you want to populate the right diversity, that's what you go for. There is other bugs that absolutely love donuts and they love pastries and they love sugar and they also love red meat. And those bugs are less favorable for good health overall. So what we're trying to do with the gut microbiome is populate it with a diverse mix of the right guys, okay? right microbes. Now, in the vagina, it's slightly different. The vagina is actually one of the most acidic places in the human body. So the microbiome in the vagina is really trying to keep that pH low. And that's why we have lactobacilli in there. Lactobacilli, as we know, are excellent at keeping acidic conditions. That's why they make such good yogurt. And lactobacilli is what we want in our vagina. When the strains start straying off and we get different bugs coming in, that is when the pH balance can be thrown off. But not only that, it just breaks the cohesive barrier that is protecting us from infection. And what's really interesting is that this isn't just about preventing STIs or preventing thrush or preventing BV. What we now know, and there's a really, really excellent researcher at Imperial College who's a gynecologist, Dr. Anita Mitra. She is a specialist in this, and she has a very good social media presence called the Gynae Geek. It's literally, she wrote her PhD on the vaginal microbiome, so she's the queen of this. But what we see now is that it impacts infection. It impacts the likelihood of HPV turning into cancer. It also impacts subfertility. Now, this is where my interest was really piqued because I work with clients who suffer with subfertility and they come to me to find out how they can improve their diets, whether there's anything in their blood markers that might be impacting their likelihood to conceive. And often none of them have ever thought to look at their vaginal health. So they don't know if their microbiome is in the right conditions to actually encourage pregnancy, because not only does the sperm have to survive the conditions in, right? But then also, once it gets in, the right microbiome, the right environment needs to be in place for pregnancy to take place, for pregnancy to happen. And what's really interesting is that when we have what's called dysbiosis, so when this bacterial community is off kilter, it's not in the right balance, inflammation goes up. And inflammatory markers are never a good thing if you're trying to conceive. Any kind of inflammation, chronic inflammation in the body sends signals to the body that this might not be a good time to have a baby, right? And so what happens is we have women who are trying to do lots of things, and this also impacts the success rate for ART, for artificial insemination, or artificial reproductive technologies, any of them. So before going in to spend all this money on stress.
Oh God. Stress, all the load on the body, the load of hormones, the clothing, the stimulation. I mean, it's horrid and it's difficult. And it's, again, only on the women.
Of course. Well, having said that, we now know that the man's part is so major. So men have got off quite free in the sense that they think that it's fine. They just turn up one day and do their thing. But actually, we know so much more now about the impact of the father's stress on childhood development, the impact of the father's stress and lifestyle on sperm quality. And actually, it's interesting because sperm comes with its own microbiome when it's ejaculated. And your vaginal microbiome and the sperm's equivalent, essentially, or the man's equivalent, they have to work together for this to happen. So it is, it takes two to tango, right? And we know a lot more now about how the man's health plays a part. But with a focus on the vaginal microbiome today, I think what's really interesting is to, for me, was to find out how women don't really think about it very much. And they don't think to investigate.
At all. I don't think they even know about it. You're right.
So what I think what's useful to know is, you know, if you think something's not right down there with your vaginal health, if your vulva feels uncomfortable, or if you have perhaps unusual discharge, go and speak to your doctor, because it's so easy to find out if there's a dysbiosis. Because we have a preference for lactobacilli in the vaginal microbiome, it's not difficult to see if it's awry. Whereas with gut microbiome, you have to do quite extensive testing to see if you've got the right strains. It's not so straightforward. Finding out if you're suffering with bacterial vaginosis, which is the most common sort of presentation for a severe dysbiosis, it's quite simple. Your GP can do it. But if you have that knowledge, then you can change it. You can go ahead and make changes to improve that. And I think with bacterial vaginosis, VB, it is not a sexually transmitted disease. There's no shame in having it. It's 50% of the time, it's not, you don't have any symptoms. It's asymptomatic.
That's the thing.
Mm-hmm. So this is the thing. So even if you don't have discomfort, even if you don't have discharge that you're worried about, it's worth having a checkup and checking out if everything's okay down there. And a good opportunity to do that is when you have your smear test. You know, you have a trained professional. So ask them questions. Yeah.
I'll share something very interesting on my view coming from France when I came to England. So in France, and I know Italy as well, for example, there is a culturally from, let's say, 15 or 16 years old, or if you're sexually active, you start seeing a gynecologist twice a year for the rest of your life, regardless, as a routine, not even a check, a routine examination. A lot of the time, it's literally an examination. Everything's fine. Thank you very much for that. But also, what that means is that, of course, you're going to find more things that could be there, but also it's a conversation. As you come into that office with this doctor, you know, there's a conversation starts. How are you? How are you? Do you have a boyfriend? Do you have, you know, how many times do you have sex? Is it nice? Are you enjoying it? Do you have pain afterwards? Do you have pain during? Whatever. This conversation starts. Because this is the thing you said, it is a symptomatic, and it is in terms of what symptoms are. But I would like to stress here that women know themselves really well, and the things are subtle, and we maybe couldn't call them symptoms, but they're there. Dysuria, pain during intercourse, for example, we've never had it before. That's something strange. In a certain position more than another, that could lead to the fact maybe uterus might have moved. You know, before that was okay. There's a change. Everything that is a sign of a change that you're not expecting, in a way, should be regarded as a symptom without becoming hypochondriac and non-realistic and just every time. But, you know, these are important to say. It could be a bit of smell. It could be a bit of an itch, could be something that just a bit, you know, literally could say, well, that's nothing, because it is nothing, but it is not your normality.
Right. And it's important. It's
your normality. Yeah.
It's really interesting you say this as well, because I think nowadays a lot of women have been on the oral contraceptive for such a long time. And what happens with the oral contraceptive is that you lose the change in your vaginal microbiome and your whole system. So when you're not on a contraceptive pill, when you're not taking hormones, your discharge, the way your vulva feels, the way your vagina feels changes throughout the month according to the time of the month, right? So literally, if you're ovulating, your discharge will become clearer and runnier to make sex basically easier, right? So it all changes throughout the month. And if you're on a hormonal contraceptive, that disappears. So we have a large proportion of the female population that has an artificially constant vaginal feel and discharge. And what happens is that then sometimes people will come off the pill and there'll be all these changes, and it'll be like, oh, I've never had this before. And it's like, well, this is what your body should be doing. It should be having these changes. And having this awareness of what your body is doing is so important. You're so right. And that's what I like about some of these new tracking apps. They encourage women to log changes in their discharge, changes in their mood, changes in their how they're feeling at their sex drive throughout the month when they're not on a hormonal contraceptive, and being in touch with how those changes take place, and then being able to then say, oh wait, this is unusual. Exactly as you said, it's not necessarily a symptom, it's not necessarily something that you would read in a textbook, but something isn't right for me at this point in my cycle. Having that knowledge is really power, and it lets you know when something is up. And it's interesting you say about this change of culture, difference in culture. So in Italy, I'm Italian, you know this. Yeah, we see our gynecologist like pretty much straight away. It's like you go in, you get checked out.
Your mother will take you when she knows that, you know, you're coming to this age, and it's okay, now right. This is it.
That's exactly right. And so you have this conversation and you become aware of the fact that you should be looking after this part of your body too. And in the UK, we don't have that as much. And I think it's a real shame because, I mean, here there's a terrible uptake even on the smear test, which is such an important prevention measure. People are really disconnected and they don't seek medical advice for issues, that any gynecological issue. And it doesn't have to be a medical person, but it's good to have a conversation, and it's good to have someone you can refer to and ask questions and find out more and know if something's not right for you or where to go if you want to have an investigation done. So another example of this that I often use as a comparison point is GBS screening, right? It's a little contentious in certain places because GBS is group B streptococcus. It is a bacteria that lives in about 2/3 of women's vaginas. But if it's active around the time of giving birth, it can be a marker for complications for the baby. So it can lead to meningitis. It can lead to sepsis if you have a prolonged labor. Now, yeah. So in the US, for example, all women are screened for GBS at about 34 weeks. And if you test positive, they give you penicillin whilst you are in labor to prevent the baby becoming overwhelmed with GBS, basically. Here, it's not offered routinely. And I think there's some, it's a little problematic. Of course, the NHS has to offer it's all about cost benefit analysis. Okay. So it may not be cost effective to screen every child, every mother before she gives birth. Yeah. Right. But if you're aware of that and it's something you want to do, you can pay £30, be screened, and then have that knowledge and discuss it with your healthcare provider. But if we don't even having conversations about the healthy vaginal microbiome, and how important, by the way, it is to prevent preterm birth. One of the biggest risk factors for preterm birth is vaginal dysbiosis. If we're not even going there.
I know. So I have two questions for you now. Question number one, do we know what is triggering GBS to be active or not?
So we do. So as I said, it's a normal part of the vaginal flora. Yeah. It's not actually unusual. But what there are some studies showing now that when you have reduced lactobacilli, so when your lactobacillus count goes down, GBS becomes a bit more active. So of course, what can you do, right? So you have your GBS screening, you pay for your GBS screening at 34 weeks. It comes back positive. What can you do? You have active GBS. Well, you can take probiotics. You can take them orally, it still has an effect, or you can take vaginal suppositories, less common in the UK, much more common in Europe, interesting, mainly around mainland Europe. And there is a brand that, there isn't any one brand I would recommend, but there is one brand that has the lactobacilli that are very good for the vagina. So it's quite an easy one to find. It's the Optibac for women, the purple box. That one has the three major strains for vaginal health. So if that happens to you and you're a bit concerned and you don't necessarily want to have intrapartum penicillin administration, which not everyone offers anyway.
This is my second question, because as we both know, the importance of the birth canal exposure for the child, newborn, especially the exposure around his face, so eyes, nose, mouth, as he passes through, will be one of the biggest start of the commensal bacteria that we're talking before in the gut, which are the good bacteria that we want. So now the question is, I don't know this. You know, if you take penicillin, would that obviously should affect all bacteria, right? You can't just target the GBS. So then you have less of those, I guess.
Yes, but as it's done during labor, so it's it's not done pre-labor. It's done during labor. What you're doing is, if you have a fast labor and baby's born and it's not complicated, it's unlikely to actually affect the exposure, because penicillin takes a while to kick in, right? To actually have its effect. What it's trying to prevent is if you end up having a prolonged labor, a difficult labor, then the penicillin will have started kicking in by then and will reduce the bacterial load. And you want to reduce the bacterial load if you're having a complicated labor. You see? Because right. It just...
Yes. Yeah, that makes more...
So there's a balance. But you're completely right. The vagina offers the blueprint for our children's microbiome. As they go through the vaginal the birth canal, they are literally inoculated with the right strains. And why is lactobacillus... So lactobacillus goes right up during pregnancy. And of course, mm-hmm. children are designed to be breastfed. And lactobacilli in the gut help to break down milk. So you're giving the baby the best possible gut bugs to be able to break down and absorb mother's milk.
What are you going to eat after? Exactly.
Yeah.
I do. We mentioned, we've spoken about this a lot on different podcasts and different talks. And, you know, now I'm just really encouraging my patients, but also people are listening to us to do what we do called vaginal juices wipe. So you just ask the midwife or yourself if you don't have the opportunity to do a natural delivery and if things like come to section, for example, emergency or not, you can still do that and then really kind of brush your uvula. And it's not as much, but it's still interesting and still it's worth it. Also, you're talking about cost and effect. I mean, this is the easiest thing you can ever do and you can have a great impact.
It's a really interesting topic and it's controversial still because there haven't been that many clinical trials to prove whether it's safe. Now, the issue with that, my second baby was breech and she just wouldn't turn. And she turned twice and then turned back. And I was like, oh my God. So in the end, I chose to have a C-section with her because I wasn't ready to take the risks of a breech delivery. And I considered this. I said, gosh, should I be seeding her? And, you know, I think that the issue with seeding, and I spoke this at length with the obstetrician about this as well. And my only issue with seeding and what I would say to anybody who's considered doing it is to make sure that when you seed, when the baby exits the birth canal, they exit in a very specific sequence from the cervix down. And if you look at the vaginal microbiome population, it changes from the top of the cervix to the opening of the vagina. So if you're going to seed, like try and do it in a way that you're getting mostly the seeding from up internally near the cervix up there, because what you don't want to do is seed your baby with a lot of sort of anal and vulval bacteria as opposed to the lactobacillus at the top. Yeah, because those can cause infection. So then you're weighing up the risk of infection with the risk of seeding. And
that's why I think the maneuver, you know, because it's difficult to do this on oneself, but, you know, a midwife can do that very well. I watched a few times that, you know, I did a few deliveries and I was trying to do this. And the technique they used was like taking a cloth, perfect with your fingers and going in, touching the cervix. So trying to do that as they were getting this cloth out, this point where the two fingers were, which were at the deepest, where I put first on the baby here. And then it would cover the baby's face. So there was, I guess, in the best possible way. I'm not sure. It would never reproduce what a real birth canal would. But, you know, it made sense to do it this way. But I'm going to jump on this because this is really interesting. A lot of studies, when we talk about the microbiome, because this is the subject of the day, it's such small things. You know, for us, we think things are very close. But you have to understand, and people have to understand this, that just on the round here, the opening of my nose, and just here on my, like, the beginning of my cheek and right at the beginning of my ear is three different worlds. It's not even like they're both, it's like there's more difference in here than there is between us and snakes, you know? Like, it's incredible the diversity and what, and this is the interesting thing about this world of microbiome. It's not just bacteria. There are so many kinds and shapes and what they do. You were saying before some eat certain things, but it's extraordinary. So, and I love that you mentioned this through that conversation, because we have, in a way, the skin microbiome, which I know you know a lot about, is also so diverse. You're going to have to understand how to do this, you know, how to seed properly, feed properly, nurture properly, different microbiomes in different places, because they are a lot.
And that's why this brings me really nicely onto one of the main things you can do to help your microbiome, your vaginal one, and your skin. But skin is a different topic. But vaginal, please don't douche. Soaps, I mean, deodorants, all these products that are designed to try and tell us, first of all, our vaginas aren't dirty, okay? Vaginas are self-cleansing. That is the point of them. And we definitely don't need to be soaping them. And soaping them and spraying them disrupts the delicate balance of these this microbiome so much. And it all it does is helps disrupt that and propagate this dysbiosis and then make you more prone to infection and more prone to having issues. So if there's one thing that I really hope people have moved away from and they are ready to let go of, it is douching, feminine spraying, feminine anything of that. It just, it's not helpful, and it doesn't help to maintain our microbiome healthy. And it's the same, similar with skin, right? There's so many products that can really disrupt our skin microbiome and cause things like eczema, dermatitis, and even worsen skin conditions like acne. So we've got to be really careful to look after the millions and millions of microbes that are looking after us. As you said, we're just their vessels, so we need to stop disrupting them.
Exactly, because they don't like it. And then they make you, there's a payback to it. But you know, interesting enough, we did kind of touch on this before on the preparation for this show, and it was about the recurrent cystitis, which I see a lot in the practice. And just because you just mentioned it, imagine that these women come in and they have a very debilitating issue, because obviously for us it's painful, but mostly it's the social aspect which is really daunting. Because when every time you know that you're going to have sex, you're going to have pain afterwards for sometimes 1, 2, 3 days, it might lead to another course of antibiotics, which you don't like because you know what it does to you, etc. You know, you become very wary of how you're going to approach this socially. So a lot of women actually, having had that through their young women life, I've had very disturbed relationships because of it. And also the men should be learning a lot more about this. That's another thing we've been trying this month, is to educate men about it. We'll talk about menopause another day, but it was interesting when you involve men into understanding what happens. But this is the same thing. It's a lot of men like, well, you don't like me if you don't want to have sex with me all the time. And the lady's like, well, no, because that position actually really will trigger cystitis or that frequency or whatever. And you have to understand that this is difficult to say, because it seems, again, it's my fault that we can't do this. But I really love you and I really find you extremely attractive. But this is happening. The social aspect is huge. The more, I guess, tragic thing about how we deal with it in this day and time mostly is that we give you antibiotics for it. And we just said, just explained, antibiotics, these obviously are designed to kill bios, which is bacteria. So if what you need to be able to keep health in those regions is to have a healthy account and diversity of bacteria, which is the gut, or specificity of bacteria in the vagina. If I keep giving you antibiotics to try and fix that, obviously we are going, we're feeding this kind of vicious circle. And I see it. I see it on a daily basis. Some ladies have 10 to 12 courses of antibiotics a year. So now, for that, imagine what happens to the rest of them. Then the digestion goes haywire, then the immune system goes haywire, because we know how important the gut microbiome is in modulating the nervous system. So then you start having, and I know it seems far-fetched, but I'm not, it's starting to show into some kind of autoimmune disease.
Yeah, no. Wow. I couldn't agree with you more. It's, listen, you know, the issue is that cystitis is so tricky because it is caused by E. coli entering the urethra, which is not supposed to be there. We know that. So antibiotics are used to prevent things like ascending pyelonephritis and huge kidney disease, because we can't, that's even harder to treat and so painful. It's, you know, not good.
I think life-threatening.
Yeah, of course. But the issue, well, you're right though. The issue is here, like, we're using antibiotics to treat this condition. And yes, sure, it kills everything off that time. It's like a nuclear bomb, kills everything. But in killing everything, you're killing off our immune system. You're killing off the communication between our gut and our central nervous system via the vagus nerve. You're killing off all the happy, healthy bugs that were there to try and keep everything in place. You then end up having thrush as well, because again, the vaginal microbiome keeps thrush at bay by keeping the pH low. When you take antibiotics and you get rid of all your friendly lactobacilli, thrush can thrive literally. So you have a different type of discomfort. And I think there's a piece of education around maintaining the vaginal microbiome healthy, but also what you said about frequency of sex and practices for sex to help and keep the risk of cystitis at bay. And this actually links in well with BV as well. So studies have shown that women who have several sexual partners and don't use condoms are more prone to BV. And it's very simple. It's nothing to do with, you know, you can have as many sexual partners as you like, of course. But every time you have sex with somebody unprotected, you are inheriting not only the bugs that they have on their penis, but also the bugs they've picked up from other women. And as we've said, the vaginal microbiome doesn't like diversity. So the more diversity you introduce, the more likely that dysbiosis will be. So condoms are very helpful for that. And they're not particularly popular, right? People don't like condoms. But if you're wanting to look after your vaginal microbiome, if you want to try and prevent complications like cystitis, especially if you're prone to them, using them could be really helpful. And then look at speaking to your partner about frequency of sex. And as you said, positions and other things that can help to keep your vagina happy. They're important conversations to have. And there's no shame in you saying, listen, I can't have sex with you 3 times a day because it's going to hurt me. And I don't want to do that. And I don't want to take antibiotics again and disrupt my entire microbial universe in all of the spheres. But what's one thing we can do for those women? I actually have clients who, as you've said, have recurring cystitis, and it is completely life altering. It's really difficult to manage. But what I will say is that good courses of probiotics are very helpful for those clients, and seeing people like yourself for, as you said, the actual way that the lower pelvis is situated and having those adjustments. We lead a life now where we're sitting down most of the day. The amount of pressure that's on our pelvis, I mean, I don't need to be telling you, Boniface, you can tell us about this. But it really changes the entire ecosystem of our pelvis. We're not supposed to be sitting down all day. We're not supposed to be sitting down wearing different materials that don't breathe all day. It's not supposed to happen. And we're doing it, and it increases the likelihood of having these recurring cystitis bouts. So if you know that you're prone to it, or if you know that you have a job where you do sit down for periods of time, and you do wear clothes that perhaps you're a spinning instructor and you're in Lycra most of the day, there are certain things you can do to help. And from my interest, you know, a good diet, staying well hydrated, and also probiotics. And it's one of the only times I would probably suggest a supplement as opposed to probiotic foods. Probiotic foods are important for everyone. And, you know, having kimchi and sauerkraut and kefir, all of those things are so helpful. But if you're very prone to dysbiosis, taking a probiotic supplement can also be really helpful.
And also local probiotic supplements, as in vaginal suppositories. We talked about it well before, because I don't think that people really know about it, that you use probiotic app, which is great, because now people know where to go. But I think it seems to me, because we've been working for 10 years on this, is that you can, if you know when you're going to have intercourse, you can get one of those little suppositories and put it before, and not before, like minutes before, but hours before. And that seems to create the arrival of all these lactobacillus. Then it will protect you from what's going to happen next. The condom is really great. And as you say, people don't use it, but it's curious because most people now in our generation grew up with it because of other problems, because AIDS at the time. But, you know, if you're born in 80 or between, let's say, 75 and 90, kind of where your normality, right? Because there was a very big disease around that we're trying to not catch and spread. So I think it's a shame that this is gone, because it's good for everyone.
Well, you're completely right. And do you remember there was old wives' tales about putting yogurt, if you had thrush, put yogurt basically on your vulva. I mean, it makes sense. I mean, I don't recommend people walk around with yogurt in their pants. It can be tricky, but it's a similar concept. And there is absolute truth in it. There are lactobacilli in yogurt. It will be helpful. Now, I would rather, as you said, you can use a probiotic vaginal suppository, and you can also eat, if you do eat dairy, eat very always organic, grass-fed, good quality, whole fat, probiotic dairy. Live cultures are, you need live cultures to make yogurt. Real yogurt is a fermentation process. If you can buy good, high quality yogurt and just have a bit every day, you don't have to have tons of it, but just a little bit every day will support your microbiome. And as soon as you're supporting your gut microbiome, you also support your vaginal microbiome and your entire immune system. And that immune system is also what helps to keep this inflammation down. And as I, the more I work in this field, the more I realize that, as you said earlier, stress, inflammation, which go hand in hand, they impact everything. And at the end of the day, we're trying to reduce postprandial inflammation. We're trying to reduce inflammation caused by stress. We're trying to reduce inflammation caused by environmental factors such as phthalates, BPA, other aggressors that we find in plastics and other environmental aggressors. All of these things contribute to having better health outcomes in every single body part, like in the whole of ourselves, right? And I think that if when we, once we start to look at food and supplements and habits that we pick up every day as a way of working towards that, then what happens is we see a result quickly. You can see a change with small daily habits to look after our vaginal microbiome, to look after ourselves and stay in tune with what our body is telling us. You can see a change within a month, you know? It's not, when I'm not saying...
This is really important because that's what we need to tell people. It changes quickly. But also, you know what's tricky? A lot of the time I have this conversation with people and they're like, you know, I'm struggling to be fertile, for example. But I know of someone who's smoking, drinking, overweight, never exercises, eats Tesco's every day, and she's on her fifth pregnancy and she wishes she wasn't pregnant. And the fascination for us, because you said something in the very beginning of this conversation about how important we are in the pandemic to see patients, because the singularity of people, the uniqueness of every genetic, of every story, of every epigenetic, the way they're reading genetic right now, their affiliation of what they are doing in their lives, their expectations, their desires, their dreams, all of that, that comes into their, who they are when we see them. It's such a complex, it's so complex in a way, but you have to just feel it rather than just know it. And that thing is, you know, they feel very, it's unfair. But I mean, again, like, it's not fair. We're not the same. We don't have the same basis. We don't have the same microbiome. We don't have the same resistance. And yet some people that you will know will be in excess of lots of things, yet not suffer so much. Or people are really, you know, trying their best and still not finding their way. So I think this is also for us to empower them and say, listen, there is no norm as such. This is the thing that you move away. Find yourself. Know what happened with your mother, with your grandmother, with your sisters. Also the fact that we totally exploded in families. This connection that female had, and male, but female more really, kind of it's gone. You know, I have patients who are giving birth at 37. They already had a husband, a life as a couple, a career. They haven't seen a kid for 25 years. They don't know. They don't have their mother, their sister, their anyone's around. And it's like, it's really kind of daunting dropping on your own in this world with these things. And you're trying to find information wherever you can. And it's often quite difficult because this information is not always in line.
Yeah.
So I'm trying, and this is what I'm trying.
Yes, and it's what you
we need pure information that is based on research, yeah. And then can you work.
This is the thing. So working in epidemiology and public health, so much of my training is looking at population trends. And I can say to you, you know, if you're XYZ, you're more likely to whatever. So this is all how it's all statistics, okay? And statistics is amazing. We can do so much with it. But what people need to remember is that of the 100 people that statistics is based on, if you look at it as 100, a sample of 100, there's only one person who's 50. There's only one person who's in the middle, right? Everybody else lies elsewhere on the graph. And there's so many factors that you have to look at to find out what your likelihood is. So you can't, it's not just about, do you smoke? Do you take your folic acid? You know, and, you know, there's so many factors. And age is one of them. And there's some factors that we know are going to have an impact. So, you know, we know smoking causes lung cancer. You're much more likely to get lung cancer if you smoke. However, there are people that get lung cancer without smoking. We also know that. But we also know that as we age, men and women, okay, let's bring that back, because that's a big area of research now, which is trying to get a voice. As you get older, men or women, after 35, the sperm quality goes down and egg quality goes down. There's no getting away from that. This is not, it's not like a, we haven't changed biologically to make having children into our 40s and 50s biologically more viable. It doesn't work like that. And it's the same for men. After 35, sperm quality goes down. The risk of miscarriage rises, as with paternal age. There's a lot of factors that are associated with paternal age as well. And I think it's an unpopular thing to say, but we have been pushed as women to focus on our careers, make sure that we, you know, find the perfect partner to spend the rest of our lives with in a Disney movie situation. And we, there's so many things that we're supposed to tick off before we bring a child into this world. And actually, I think if you have a maternal instinct, if you, not everyone wants kids, by the way, and having kids, I can safely say, don't have kids if you don't want them, because they're really hard work. Like, please don't have them if you don't want them. Like, you won't like them. So, but if you have a maternal instinct and you want children as a priority, don't let like the world tell you that that shouldn't be a priority. That's not fair. You know, I think you don't necessarily, I had kids, I was still doing my PhD when I was having, I had kids, I hadn't finished my studies. And everyone was like, oh my God, you can't have a kid and do a PhD. And I'm like, what do you, watch me. Like, what do you mean I can't? Biology isn't waiting for me to get my PhD. Like, you have to do. So I think that there's some things that we know have an impact. There's some people who may look like they should be able to get pregnant straight away, but you know what? It's called the miracle of life for a reason. And I know maybe a couple of people who get pregnant really easily or even by mistake. I know maybe a couple of people, but I think that that's a story that's been told to us, which isn't actually true. And there's a wonderful researcher who has written the 1% effect. I don't know if you've heard of her, but she's written extensively, I can't remember her name now, extensively about how fertility in the world is decreasing at the rate of 1% per year. So fertility now is 50% less than it was 50 years ago. And we're basically heading towards a world where having children naturally is becoming more and more difficult. So frankly, there are always going to be those people who get pregnant by mistake, you know, having not planned it at all. There's people who get pregnant where he's had a vasectomy and she's on the pill. Like, it does happen. Okay. But that is the rare side. People don't tend to get pregnant by mistake anymore. And trying to shy away from focusing on the importance of actually nurturing ourselves if we want to get pregnant. Don't just leave it up to chance. It's a really important choice. So I think nurturing ourselves, men and women who want to have children, anyone who wants to have kids should nurture that side of them and know what to do to give their gametes the best chance and to give their offspring the best chance. Because we are setting a blueprint for life. Literally, it's amazing, a miracle. But we have to take it seriously. I think it's become like a sideshow and to our careers. And I don't think that's the right way to approach it. I'm sure people will disagree with me, but that's my view.
Yeah, I don't think so. Well, I don't. But no, I don't think so. I think it's very true. I think I've seen myself and lost one being really complicated. I feel it is a real journey. Erica, I hate when people ask me that, but really quickly, we're going to sum it up. So the vaginal microbiome, what can we do to make it better? What can we do to make sure it doesn't go into this dysbiosis, which you explained really well, which means some kind of pop kilter, and how important it is for us to be looking into it, if I may say so, because it's a difficult space to investigate. This is why we want to encourage women to go and see practitioners and see doctors, because, you know, it is much easier to look at the male external genitals that is as a female, just by the nature of how it's shaped. So it needs to be examined regularly if you know something is not right for you. So tell us, just a resume, 3 points about the vaginal microbiome. What can we do to keep it healthy, make sure it doesn't go, and if it has, what can bring it back to health?
I think definitely take a look at your diet. Make sure that you have a wide range of probiotic foods. take probiotics if you want to, and lots of fruits, vegetables, whole foods, steer away from lots of added sugar and very highly processed foods. They're known to impact the balance of lactobacillus in our vagina as well as other things. The second thing is to get to know your body, get to know your cycle. If you are taking a contraceptive pill, still get to know your vagina, get to know what it feels like, if it feels okay, if sex is painful, talk to somebody. Once you get to know it, find somebody to talk to about it so that you can communicate with them and ask questions. And then I think the third thing would have to be, don't douche. please avoid hygiene products. Yeah. It's not necessary. And get your smear test. Sorry, I slipped a fourth in, but I really think it'd be good.
No, it's great.
Yeah, great. Do that. So.
Thank you so much. Thank you for this hour nearly, 50 minutes. I think we
can. I know, sorry, we went over time.
I know, you're like, it's a good time. You have so much to tell us, so much to teach us. And I hope we'll do some more of those talks on different subjects, because this was obviously quite specific about the microbiome, but there's quite a lot of other topics that you're very, very share. So I think for all our Women Series members and those who are joining us on Spotify and now on Apple as well, you can find us. I hope you enjoyed that chat. I hope you learned as much as I did, because there's a lot of things to learn. And I hope that Federica will be happy to join us again for more of those.
I would love to.
In the meantime, bye-bye, everyone. Thank you for joining.
Thank you.
Take care. Bye-bye.